Numbers chapter 23, the 11th talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on July 10, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Numbers chapter 23 this week, but first I'm going to look back at chapter 22. This is a unique setting in which to teach. It is, and it's one of the joys of teaching here, that you as a congregation interact more with the text as someone teaches here than is typical in other churches, which is a very good thing. And that's very important. It's important to understand that we as teachers here do not see ourselves as authoritative teachers. That is, we aren't telling you we are not giving you the authoritative interpretation that ought not be doubted. Rather, we are trying to, with the most integrity that we have, to tell you what we think that the text means and why we think that is the case. It is your responsibility to follow along and make your own independent decision as to what you think is true and what is not true, because it's the text that's authoritative, not our interpretations of the text. So you have to wrestle with that and come to your own conclusions. Last week I talked about Balaam and his donkey, and throughout the week people made comments to me about various things that they observed or questions they had or whatever. And that's wonderful. It is helpful to have people interact with what I have to say. I find it very stimulating to hear people's questions and their observations, and then I go back and rethink it. So it's very helpful. There was one comment that Chris Swanson made that was particularly intriguing. He raised the issue of whether that whole section where it talks about Balaam and the donkey, could that be a dream? And I started thinking about that, and the more I thought about it, the more intriguing that possibility was. So I want to talk about that just a little bit. Now, what would cause one to entertain such an option? Because it does not say in the text, "And then Balaam had a dream." And in the absence of such a statement, is it legitimate to even entertain the possibility that that section is a dream? And I think the answer is yes, it is legitimate to entertain such a possibility, that there are other ways that one can indicate that something is a dream rather than to come out and say this that follows was a dream. What kinds of clues would do that? Well, I'm not sure. But just think of movies that you have seen. Movies in which you have action, and then there is a section which is a dream. If it's going to be really overt, especially in a bit old-fashioned, the movie's going to have wavy lines or something that indicates a change in consciousness. And then the dream. But I have seen films more recently in which you have reality, a non-dream part of the film, and then it moves into a dream part of the film. But the whole time the audience is asking the question, is this dream or is this just reality? That there isn't a sharp break that's been made that is telling the viewer that now this is dream. It just kind of moves into this other part of the film, and it gets weirder, but there's no sharp demarcation between what is not dream and what is dream. Now, I suspect that the vast majority of you have seen far more films than I have seen. But you all have probably seen that kind of phenomenon. And it seems to me in the more modern films, the tendency is to make it less overt when you move into a dream sequence. In fact, there are some films in which that I've seen where it was never absolutely clear that this section was a dream section, but you're suspicious that it was. Why would a filmmaker do such a thing? Well, there could be lots of reasons that a filmmaker could do such a thing. The films that I've seen most recently, where that has been done, and unfortunately I can't remember any of them, I think that the point was that the distinction between reality and dream is a very fine distinction. That there's very little difference between reality and dream. And if that's the point that you want to make, then it makes sense that in your film you'd slide from one into the other without a sharp line of demarcation. In this particular section, in Balaam and his donkey, what are the possible clues that this is a dream? There are many biblical scholars who have decided that this section was added later. And they've made the observation that you could cut this piece out and it would make very little difference in the narrative. That it flows right from what comes before to what comes right after. And in fact, there's almost a repetition of the same line. It doesn't say exactly the same thing. Just before the section with the donkey, it says in verse 21, "So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab." At the end of this section, it says, at the end of verse 35, it says, "So Balaam went along with the leaders of Balak." So there are biblical scholars who have said that this must have been just stuck in here. And it was a later addition. So there is something that is that kind of sets this apart, that the transition from what comes before to this little section is abrupt. It's noticeable. Okay, what are the other possible clues? Last week, there was someone brought attention to the fact that God tells Balaam to go with Balak's delegation, and then it says God became angry with Balaam for going with Balak's delegation. So he gets angry with him for doing the very thing that he had been told to do by God. That seems strange. Now, what I had suggested is there's another way to take the language that makes it less strange, and that is that when he was going, God became angry with him. It becomes that's a little less strange, but it is still strange. If we've moved into a dream, strange things happen. That's less jarring. The next, a donkey speaks. And there have been commentators who have written lots on that section. Whether donkeys can speak, whether they have vocal cords, whether that could possibly happen. But in this section, it happens. If I were to tell you a story in which I said a donkey spoke, that would be jarring. You'd wonder what's going on. The next thing, after the donkey speaks, there's no expression of surprise on the part of Balaam. That's dreamlike. So you can have really weird things happen and nobody's surprised in the dream. Next, there's no mention of Balak's delegation in this section whatsoever. Presumably they're traveling together. That's what it leads you to believe just before this section and just after they're traveling together. Or apparently so. Why are they not there? Well, if this is a dream, they don't have to be there. And the last thing I'll mention is Balaam is used to receiving communications from God at night. So that having a dream would be very consistent with the way that he receives communications from the gods. So when you put it all together, I think, I'm not certain, I wish it were a little neater. If the line before and the line after were more, if they were exactly the same, I would be more tempted to say this is a dream. But in any case, I think that that's a strong possibility. If that's the case, why would the author not just tell us that this is a dream? What would be his purpose for blending the two and not making it explicit? And I think the reason for that would be that this is not just a dream. That if this is a dream, God has chosen the dream as the vehicle for communicating to Balaam something very important and very serious. And I think Balaam is prepared to receive it as something very serious, even if it is a dream. Because Balaam is used to receiving communications from God at night. And I think he would take it very seriously. So this would carry the weight of an actual event. So I think that that's a strong possibility, that this section is actually a dream. And that the readers at the time would have picked up on the clues and said, this has got to be a dream. This isn't something that actually happened. But it is a communication from God and is to be taken seriously. Okay. Now, in entertaining the possibility that this is a dream, let me point out something that I'm not doing. I believe God could have made the donkey talk. It is not disturbing to me, necessarily, that a donkey talks in this particular section. I'm not embarrassed by such a possibility. God spoke from a burning bush, and a burning bush has even fewer vocal cords than does a donkey. And I think that in that section, that is clearly not a dream. There are no indications that that's a dream. There are no clues in the text that should be taken as a dream, that God actually spoke from the bush. What's different here is, it seems to me that there are some possible clues that this is to be taken as a dream. So it's not the miraculousness of it that wants me to take it as a dream. It's just I'm looking at the clues in the text, and I'm suspicious that maybe that's the way it's to be taken. And in general, I'm not embarrassed to have the Bible talk about supernatural events. God can do that. The only question is, I only want to find them where they are. I don't want to find them where they aren't. So the question is the clues. What are the clues in the text? And what are they? Where are they directing us? One of the things that has been impressed upon me as I've been working through, especially the Pentateuch, is the Old Testament is not just a dry chronicling of events. That the Old Testament, especially the Pentateuch, is very deliberately constructed. It's been very carefully put together. And I'm more and more convinced of that, that every word counts. Every word has been selected very carefully. It is purposeful. The authors have only included those events which lead to the points that the author wants to make. And each of those events have been told in a way that directs us to understand the points that the author wants to make. And the stories have been told very artfully. This is the Pentateuch is really an art form. It's been very, very well constructed in such a way that rather its purpose is not primarily to impart information. Its purpose is to get us to think, to engage our minds. And in order to do that, it has chosen what Kierkegaard would describe as indirect communication. That is, rather than coming out and saying exactly what the author wants to say, the author kind of teases you. And the author's purpose is not so much to come right out and say, make the point in one sentence, but rather to say, look over there. Think about that. Because if one comes to the truth that way, they're engaged with it. It's more, they will make it their own. Whereas if you just have someone memorize a propositional statement, they won't necessarily make that truth their own. And I would argue that the Pentateuch in particular is designed to just suggest things that you need to think about more fully and to hash through. Okay, so for those reasons, I'm inclined to think that Chris's suggestion is worthy of careful consideration. I am hoping to leave plenty of time at the end and we can talk about this more at the end. I'd be glad to. Okay, Numbers chapter 23, first six verses. So at this point in time, Balaam has arrived in Moab, and Balak has taken Balaam up to a high place where they can see a portion of the people of Israel camped out on the plain. Verse 1. Then Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here. And Balak did just as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, stand beside your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to a bare hill. Now God met Balaam, and he said to him, I have set up the 7 altars, and I have offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and you shall thus speak thus. So he returned to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering, he and all the leaders of Moab. And he took up his discourse and said, okay, I'll wait for the discourse. So here's the setting. They're up on a high hill. They can see the plains of Moab. And I don't understand why, but each time before Balak gives an oracle, they go to a place where they can only see a portion of the people of Israel. I don't know if there is no place from which they can all be seen, or whether that's a conscious decision. We only want to go places where you can only see part of them. That I don't know. Each time they build 7 altars, 7 is a significant number in Semitic culture. It's a number that's of particular importance in religious ritual. They build 7 altars, and they sacrifice 7 bulls and 7 rams. Bulls and rams being the most expensive animals that were possible. 7 of each. And those are offered in a burnt offering. Most offerings, the animal is cooked. A portion is burned for God, and then the rest of it is eaten by the participants or given out to the families of the participants. But a whole burnt offering, that's a situation in which the animal is entirely consumed by flames on the altar. No one eats any of it. So this is the most significant of the sacrifices, the most weighty of the sacrifices. Balaam then turns to Balak, and apparently in Mesopotamian culture, it's common for the one requesting the oracle to be a participant in the ritual that's performed, and that's what's happening here. Balak stays by the altars, while Balaam goes away, goes to another hilltop, where he will hope to receive a word from God. That's what Balaam does. God comes to him and says, I'll tell you what to say. And then Balaam returns back to the hilltop where the offerings are being offered. And verses 7 and following are the oracle that God has given to Balaam. And he took up his discourse and said, "From Aram, Balak has brought me, Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come, curse Jacob for me, and come, denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? As I see him from the top of the rocks, and I look at him from the hills, behold, a people who dwells apart and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." Then Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them." And he answered and said, "Must I not be careful to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth?" So the word that Balaam receives from God and then proclaims to Balak is not a curse. That's what Balak is expecting, but it doesn't turn out to be a curse. It starts out by indicating that Balak went to great pains to get someone to proclaim a curse on Israel. He sent for someone far away, 360 miles away. And that's where he called Balaam from, for the purpose of cursing the descendants of Abraham who are parked on the plains of Moab. And Balaam says, "How shall I curse whom God has not cursed?" No one can curse that which God has not cursed. That whoever God blesses is blessed. Whoever God curses is cursed. And no one and no thing can countermand that. That is the way that it is, and that cannot be changed. There's no one who rivals in power God. And as Balaam then looks out on the plain, he sees the Israelites down there, and he says they are a people who dwells apart, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. As he looks down at the Israelites, what he sees is a people that is a special people. They are a holy people in that sense. They've been set apart. They are different from everybody else, every other nation on the earth. They play a unique role in history, always have and always will. And he's recognizing that fact. They have been blessed by God. Just as God had said to Abraham, he said that his descendants would be as the sand. They would be innumerable. And as Balaam is looking out, that is indeed the case. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? So he's looking out, and indeed, they have become very numerous. They have been blessed, just as God had said that he would do to them. Then the last two lines are very curious. He says, "Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." This is a theme that we'll see in the second oracle, and it carries on through. Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his. He's suggesting, first of all, that the Israelites are upright. Well, we know from the account that we've read through in the rest of the Pentateuch that the Israelites haven't entirely been angels. That they have been faithless on numerous occasions. They have been disobedient on numerous occasions. And yet, the indication here is that they are indeed upright. Well, it must be talking about them being upright in a different sense. That is, they are upright not on the basis of what they have done, but they are upright on another basis. And it's not telling us what that other basis is. And then Balaam asks that his end be the same, that he have the same end as the end of the upright, the end of this nation. That's another statement that's curious, because we'll find out later in Numbers that Balaam is put to death by the Israelites because because God told them to put these people to death, people who had been wicked. He joins the Midianites, and God tells them, tells the Israelites to put them all to death. And there are indications that, that Balaam was indeed a wicked man, and we'll look at that next week. So those are, that's a very curious way for this oracle to end. Continuing on then, verse 13. Then Balak said to him, please come with me to another place from where you may see them, although you will only see the extreme end of them and will not see all of them, and curse them for me from there. So he took him to the field of Zophim, to the top of Pisgah, and built seven altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And he said to Balak, stand here beside your burnt offering while I myself meet the Lord yonder. Then the Lord met Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And he came to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering and the leaders of Moab with him. And Balak said to him, what has the Lord spoken? So Balak has a good idea. He says, we just got to, we did it from the wrong mountain. Let's go to a different mountaintop and let's do this again. Let's see if we can't get a better result. I mean, we got to get a curse out of this somehow. So they go to a different mountain. They repeat the entire procedure. The seven altars, the 14 sacrifices, and Balaam goes to another hilltop to receive a word from God and then comes back. Balak is probably filled with anticipation that this is going to work. This has got to do the job. And so he asks eagerly, what has the Lord spoken? Verse 18, then he took up his discourse and said, arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of a wild ox. For there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Then Balak said to Balaam, do not curse them nor at all, nor bless them at all. But Balaam answered and said to Balak, did I not tell you, whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do? So this second oracle repeats many of the same elements that are in the first. It just expands upon it. He appeals to Balak to listen to what he has to say, and then he enters into the argument that God is not like a man, in that God is not inconstant. He doesn't lie. He doesn't go back on his promises. Whatever he says he will do, that's what he does. Then he goes on to say, I have received a command to bless, and when he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it. So therefore, given who God is, a God who is constant and faithful to his word, he's not going to go back on that. God has blessed the Israelites. That will not change. No one can change that. Then once again, he says, there's nothing wrong. There's no basis for cursing that can be found in Israel. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob. He has not seen trouble in Israel. And apparently in both instances, what it's talking about, there's no basis for cursing there. That's curious, because in the wilderness there had indeed been reason for God to discipline Israel. Because they would not go into the promised land when they were told to do so, God said, you will spend 40 years wandering in the desert. and this whole generation will die. So God had found reason to discipline them. What's being said here must be different from that. The Lord, his God, is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. In other words, God is their king who is right there in and among them. This is one of the things that sets them apart. In verse 22, it goes back to this theme that God bringing them out of Egypt is a very significant event in the history of mankind. That is God's activity where he's reaching right down into the history of mankind and acting on the behalf of his people. And that's seen as a very significant event. Then he goes on to say there's no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. None of that can work. None of that can countermand what God has determined to be the blessing of Israel. And God works differently with Israel. Rather than through omens and divinations, God comes out and says what's going to happen. At the proper time, God says what will be. And then the last section, he likens Israel to a lioness. A lioness that's just rising up from its rest, who will not lie down until it devours its prey. So this is a lioness that's getting up to go out and hunt. And it is going to go out and get its prey, and it will be successful. And it will drink the blood of the slain. So once again, this is not a curse. This is a prediction of good things for Israel. It's a reaffirmation that Israel is blessed, not cursed. So when he comes back, Balak says, don't say anything. I mean, every time I tell you to curse them, it ends up being a blessing. So don't curse them or don't bless them. It always turns out wrong. But Balaam's response is, whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do. Balaam has learned well from his experiences prior to coming to Balak. It has been impressed upon him that he must say only what God tells him to say. And Balaam has been duly warned, and he's taken that to heart. Okay, let's stop there. The next section goes with the third oracle. The thing that comes to mind when I read through this passage is something that Jacques Ellul talks about. Jacques Ellul in the technological society talks about technique, and what he means by technique is the tendency on the part of certain cultures in particular to develop methods, the most efficient method that will produce the result that they want to get. And he refers to that as technique. And in the book, he's talking about modern society being a technological society. That is, ours is a society that's given over to technique. In every realm of human endeavor, we are looking for the technique that will work, the right method. And in particular, we have married scientific inquiry with the development of technique. So science has come to our aid to find those methods which are the most efficient, the most effective. And those have to be empirically based. Science needs data, measurable data, quantifiable data. And so we come up with ways of designing methods that produce the right empirical results. But in his discussion of all this, he talks about the earliest field of human endeavor in which technique was applied. And he argues that that's in magic. That the ancient cultures were given over to magic. Magic was very important to them. And they approached magic from a technique perspective. That is, what do we have to do to get the result that we want to get? And the reason that came to mind is because Balak is approaching it from that perspective. Balak knows what he wants the result to be. And the result that he wants is he wants the Israelites to be cursed. So the question is, how do we get the gods, and in particular Yahweh, to curse the people of Israel? So they do everything right, the seven altars, the 14 animals sacrificed, all from a hilltop where they can see a portion of the Israelites. Balaam goes to another hilltop. They're doing everything right, but it doesn't get the right result. So Balak's thinking is, we didn't get the method quite right. Let's try it from another hilltop. So they're going to make this, they're going to keep making adjustments in the method until they get the right result. I find that interesting because I think we're all given over to technique. That we are prone to see God as being manipulable. And that if we can just figure out how to approach God the right way, we can get the result that we want from Him. What we really want from God, if we're honest, is for Him to use our power, His power, in the way that we would like Him to use it. And any attempt to do that would be akin to technique. We are trying to manipulate God. God is not manipulable, and that's the point of these two oracles. God will not be manipulated. God is a person. It is interesting that in the Bible, God is not presented as this impersonal force like gravity, to whom there could be no appeal. There's no way you can appeal to gravity. God is a person. He can be appealed to. And we ought to appeal to Him. I think we can't help but appeal to Him. One person to another. But we are subservient to Him. And we must always be subservient to Him. We can never come to God with demands. That is out of place. We can never come insisting that God do what we want Him to do. But we can come to God asking for a favor. We can express our concerns to Him. And as a person, He can identify with those concerns. He takes them seriously. But never can we come to Him with demands. It's always asking a favor. And it always needs to be accompanied with the spirit in which Jesus asked favors of God. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was going through complete turmoil, knowing that He was facing the cross. And it was an agonizing period of time for Jesus. But He concluded His appeal, His request for a favor from God, that this cup pass Him by, with, "Not my will, but Thy will be done." But ultimately, God knows what's best. We don't know what's best. So we have to come humbly asking a favor, but acknowledging that God knows what's best and He'll do what's best. And hoping that that will be the case. That really should be our fervent prayer, that God will do what He purposes to do because He knows best. There are all kinds of ways that, I mean, I'm sure that you can identify with this, the struggle of appealing to God and not wanting to insist that He do what I think is best. And there are all kinds of ways that I end up trying to manipulate God in my prayers and in my thoughts. How can I get God to do what I want Him to do? How can I approach Him such that that'll happen? And I have to be very introspective and recognize that I'm doing that and pull myself up short and say that's wrong. That any form of manipulation of God is wrong. He is not manipulable and I ought not manipulate Him. That's out of place. Okay. Questions or comments?
I wasn't here for all of last week, so tell me, Balaam is not a prophet of God specifically, is he? Is that correct?
Balaam is apparently a seer. He's from Mesopotamia, and he's apparently a seer in the tradition of Mesopotamia. So he is one who is believed to be able to see into the future better than other people can. Mm-hmm. He receives messages from God or from the gods, and he can encourage the gods of a people or the god of a people he can put distance between the god of a people and that people. He can alienate one from the other. And that's what Balak wants him to do, is to drive a wedge between Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, and the Israelites, such that the Israelites will then be vulnerable.
Okay. My question is, and this is just kind of for curiosity's sake, is Balaam a different type of prophet than the prophets of, than God's prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, etc., even in his relation to God?
Yes.
And that, I've heard, I don't remember who, say, the prophets are speaking out of, to some extent, God gives them specific words to say, but to some extent, they just speak from their understanding of God.
Mm-hmm.
And Balaam is, even the language, God puts a word in his mouth, sounds completely involuntary, what he's saying.
Well, as we go on, in the fourth oracle, it appears to become involuntary. In the first three, I don't know that it's involuntary. I think he is saying what God has told him to say. Now, how that differs in mechanics from a prophet in the Old Testament, a Jewish prophet in the Old Testament, I don't know how that differs in mechanics. But there is a difference between Balaam and the prophets in the Old Testament. And in fact, when it says that God came to Balaam, it uses a verb that only occurs with non-Israelite spokesmen for God. There are half dozen times in the Old Testament where God speaks through a non-Jew. And it's a different verb that's used in each of those cases from the verb that's used when an Israelite prophet speaks. So I think we are to see Balaam as very different. Yes.
Again, for curiosity, what are the different verbs, or what do they each mean?
Well, it's just God came to him, but it's verb to come
than
we see with the Israelite prophets. And my suspicion is that Balaam does use the word Yahweh. He uses the name Yahweh, not consistently, but frequently through here. My suspicion is that he learned about the Israelites from the delegation that came. I don't know this for sure, but that's my suspicion. And then he begins to use the name of their God when he's referring to the God that he's dealing with. I don't think, from the rest of the evidence, it does not appear to me that he has a relationship with God in which he truly trusts Yahweh.
Okay, this is just a random thought here, but if you look in biology, you can take any aspect of it, and the complexity of it is just as true and just as complex at any aspect, whether you slice a fly or a grapefruit or take a visual of the sun rising in some random corner of the earth. God is there, the reality of whatever. Well, I take that and I apply it to Revelation, where we tend to be myopic as a people, and we look at what is recorded as this is the only place God is speaking truth and will be applicable to generations coming down the road. Certainly, I'm not attacking that, and I think it has happened that way, with Jesus coming and then the relation of his words to the Old Testament. But I can't help wonder if God was not also speaking to other people throughout history and through those who have not been recorded, and it was just as much truth to those local indigenous cultures and to the traditions passed down, to truth communicated to those obscure traditions and to those obscure cultures, as it was in the Old Testament, as we now see it recorded, and as it's been taught over the centuries. I'm not sure if I've even communicated that to you in a coherent manner, but if I have, would you like to comment on it?
I'd be glad to comment on it.
Right on.
Is it possible that God, well, first of all, God communicates lots of different ways. I mean, it seems to me that just looking at nature, there is a sense in which that is communication from God. But that is not propositional, it is not propositional in form. I have to interpret that experience with nature. And I don't have a communication that's written out in words that I can interact with. So there is a difference between that and God speaking words through a prophet. So traditions in which a prophet in some other culture has been spoken to by God and relays those words to us. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it is possible that God has communicated with other cultures and maybe even in words. It seems to me that that's very possible. But I have no assurance that that has happened. I don't know which communications are truly communications that have been from God, that have been relayed to other cultures. God does seem to have chosen Israel to play a unique role, that Israel has been selected to be the mouthpiece for God as a nation, has been selected to be a mouthpiece for God unlike any other nation in the world. So when the prophets of Israel speak, I have to listen. And I take that to be authoritative. Any other claim that another culture would have, that they have prophets that receive the word from the one true God, that has to undergo scrutiny in a different way. So when the prophets of Israel speak, I would put that in a categorically different status than other claims of prophecy. Do you want to respond?
Yes, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with that. But I let's just take Israel. Let's take centuries back. You could have a number of people, maybe a couple other people like Isaiah that were prophesying, turn or burn. And they also, in their, because Israel was not just in this very little corner of the earth. I think Israel was probably much larger, maybe not much larger, and I may be showing my ignorance here, but I think it may be larger than what I tend to think it as.
Like, you mean more significant?
No, just larger. It would be the equivalent of seeing Israel as this group of people in the midst of Eugene, where there are many other Christians, and God just as real there as here. And yet the only person who is recorded throughout history is David. And God may have very well used you to be the voice in which is recorded and passed down through the generations, and yet at the same time that you existed, that you exist, there are other mouthpieces that are doing the same message and communicating to the people of Israel at that time. Again, this is all speculation. What if?
Right.
It's not even,
right.
Shouldn't even bring it up because there's no way to validate it. It was just a curiosity, mm-hmm. So I think mm-hmm. We should probably just snuff it out.
Right. Yeah, it could be that God spoke to other people in Israel who made proclamations that were authoritative, but they were not preserved in a form that we have assurance of what they said and that it is indeed authoritative.
Yeah.
Okay.
So David, back on this controversy about the, go and then I'm angry with you about going.
Right.
Interesting story, and interesting in a couple ways. Here this guy's a seer, and yet he doesn't see the angel standing before him, but his donkey does.
Right.
Kind of outshines him here. But with regard to, in verse 22 where it says God was angry because, can that participle be, could it be translated as or while or when? I guess my thinking here is this guy, as he's going along riding on the donkey, if things start coming into his mind, I mean, he's got to be a consummate bargainer. I mean, he's made mm-hmm. his living through mm-hmm. the years as a seer, and probably there's some bargaining that goes mm-hmm. on with that.
Mm-hmm.
He's riding along in the hot sun thinking, maybe I will say something other than what the Lord wants me mm-hmm. to say here. I mean, God, knowing what he's thinking, if at that point he goes, no, you're not going to do that. I'm going to put an angel in the way. I'm going to stop you. I'm going to bring you back to your senses. I'm going to show you who I am. I mean, that makes some sense to me. I don't know if the translation would allow for the because to be translated in some other way.
Right. It could. It is possible. It would be unusual, but it would be possible for this to read, but God was angry when he was going.
Right.
So you could take out then the causal part would no longer be there.
Right.
And it could be that Balaam is seeing this the same way Balak sees it. That is, if we just have to get the procedure down right, and then we'll get the right result. So Balaam may be seeing it that even though God has indicated that he will only be able to say what God wants him to say, that he's thinking, I'm going to be able to get the result that I want. And he may be being chastised for that. I mean,
David, I have a couple questions. The first one may have to do with what you're talking about next week. And if so, you can dismiss it and we can move on to the second one. But do you think that... ultimately, we know that Balaam dies.
Right.
And it seems like the way that the biblical authors write about it, that there was some sort of justice in that happening.
Right.
Do you think that when Balaam, these three different times, is told basically the same thing by God, that ultimately I'm not here to curse the children of Israel, is God like holding Balaam accountable for not listening to him the first time? And is there a sense in which Balaam did it once and he got his answer and he wasn't supposed to be going to the next mountain? And that ultimately that maybe his motivations were that he really did want to ultimately be blessed by Balak in a monetary way, and so he was continuing the little...
Try.
Is that... And if you're going to speak to that next week, that's fine.
No, I should.
Okay.
I really hadn't thought of that. I mean, that's a possibility. I'm inclined to just see Balaam as so cowed by what's happened that he is very obedient
mm-hmm.
through this section.
You to see, Balak or to God?
To God,
okay.
That he's just saying what's been told to him. He's
right.
being very careful to do so.
Yeah.
So I think he was scared by what he had been through. But after this is done, the indications are that he engages in wicked behavior.
Right.
And therefore is judged for that.
Okay.
So I'm inclined to see these three oracles as being... three times in which Balaam is playing the role that the donkey had played earlier.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you thought that the correspondence with the three times that the donkey tries to keep him from being destroyed by
right.
the angel and hitting,
right.
which also might lend itself to a kind of a dream sequence sort
right.
of idea.
Right. And I think what's happening is in the dream, it's Balaam who's riding the donkey. It's the donkey that is keeping Balaam from being killed by the angel.
Right.
In this situation, we've got Balaam playing the role of the donkey, trying to warn Balak.
Yeah.
But Balak keeps
beating him
every time he doesn't curse him.
Okay. That was going to be my second question for you. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Balaam almost sounds like he's playing the role of like we see in the movies, the confidential informant. You know, he's working for the police, mm-hmm, but he's mm-hmm really working for the bad mm-hmm guy, but he's mm-hmm essentially working for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Is Balaam still laboring under the pagan polytheistic worldview? Does he see God as the only one true God, or is he seeing Yahweh as the ascendant God for the moment? I mean, because he never really seems to drop this idea that he can play both sides of the street, and that once the Israelites pass on, he's going to be back,
right,
you know, with whoever happens to be the ascendant God and right who he's going to, you know, pony up to.
Right. That's the way I'm inclined to read it, that during this little period of time, he sees that he has no option but to be obedient to this God that seems to have a lot of power right now. But in the polytheistic worldview, that could change tomorrow. And I think that's what he's counting on. I don't think Balaam is faithful to God in any sense. He's just being compliant in this circumstance. Okay, one more.
I appreciate the fact that you hit on the significance of the passage, which was you can't manipulate God. And I think the one good approach to coming at the significance for studying the Old Testament again is in the names Yahweh, or the Tetragrammaphram, which later on during the Babylonian period they chose not to put a name to it, or not to to say it as they invoked, was based on the verb to be, I am that I am, therefore no name, he can't be manipulated. And I think what is so awesome in the passage again is unfortunately in the translation we don't get Yahweh, or we don't get the Hebrew letters. Mm-hmm. And when it is seen by Jews, that's a name of, for example, that's a name that invokes reverence and fear and awe. And again, we see how that God keeps his promise in blessing Israel to preserve the significance of Israel, rather, is the preservation of the seed of Isaac, and what was promised to Abraham. And it's because the children of Israel are no better than the land that they're, the people in the land that they're going to take from. And Balak is just another oracle, like the Greeks later on during the Homeric period, beginning about 900, went to the oracle at Delphi in order to get their direction. And that's that Mesopotamian idea carried through historically for centuries. And this is because it is within man to want direction from someone they can see. And here you have God overpowering those ideas. And that's where we find the good news in the passage that squares away with the mystery revealed in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. We not only want a God that we can see, but a God that we can have influence over.
Right, because of power in the name, we can manipulate
it. Right. I mean, it's really hard to root that out of ourselves, that desire to use God, to manipulate him. Okay, thanks.